of the world and the time in which they live. And that's why the Indonesian gesture is so important, and why it should be endorsed. The only caveat is that the Hanoi leaders see these visits for what they are, and not as evidence that the sustained policy of force is beginning to pay off. Indonesian gesture is
Thank
so
you.
Important.
Before I open the floor for discussion,
and why it should
like
be endorsed.
The, time to end
the only caveat is that Hanoi leaders see these visits for what they are, not as evidence that the sustained policy of force is beginning to pay off.
It saddens me to see again, as I have seen it a number of times.
I think I'll stop there. I have a lot of other notes, but I must have already expended my time.
Thank you. Before I open the floor for discussion, I just would like to give the time to Anne, who would like to respond to some of the comments made by the doc. Please, Anne.
It rather saddens me to see again, as I have seen in a number of times, an apparent misunderstanding between people who in the operational sense have been very much steeped in the knowledge of a society and a culture and its symbolism in all levels, but confronted in an academic context, perhaps as I think you have done, Doug, running into difficulties because you tend to utilize judgmental, value-laden terms which do not have exact reference. Contributions may not be accepted as much as they should be. If I may give some illustrations, because I feel that many of us have a lot to gain from what you're doing. When you use the term sick, one doesn't know what you mean by wealth. When you said, for example, double cross, duplicity, betrayal. Well, I've been reading not too long ago some intensive, detailed historical descriptions of Italian Renaissance city-states. All of those terms could be used for the interplay of politics, political leadership, factions, and so forth of them. On the other hand, in the long term, there are those who will see this as a very creative, resulting in very creative outcomes later. So I think one has to have, let me put it this way, define one's terms. If I take the notion of rationality, I will take it in the following conventional sense, an irrationality, which was another term you used. Rationality would be the relationship of means to goals. That is, a rational way of implementing a goal is an effective way of implementing a goal. One could further say, is it an efficient way of implementing a goal? I do not know whether you mean that. I would further divide goals into explicit goals, and very often the goals of the explicit statements of leaders, as you know, as to their goals are not their real goals. So that, then what are the goals? If one can ascertain them, then ask, are the means related in terms of possible effectiveness or ongoing effectiveness to the goals? Then one will be able to decide for oneself, and we can avoid many arguments in saying whether they are irrational or not irrational. When you talk, for example, you use terms rigidity. I suspect, in fact, I think it can be substantiated that those who are studying administration and colonial administration years ago, say in the 30s and the 40s, were talking about the steel frame of British colonial service as rigid and inflexible. And as I recall from reading books of that period, the Dutch administration was considered far more flexible and, quote, a better type of administration. Well, in certain ways, certain aspects, better for whom? Inflexible for whom? To what result? Today we are talking about the advantages of the residues, the operational residues of the British steel frame of colonial administration. Now, if one talks partly because one of the one of the bases from which we start as a desirable goal is economic development. And so everyone talks economic development. I could give illustrations, I think, and I haven't done that in some of my some papers I've done in leadership studies, that leaders using the term because it is fashionable have really no intention of actually implementing developmental goals. There are situations in which the intention is there, the goal of implementing is there, the means are not really available, or if those means are started, what the consequences are such that other goals are endangered and therefore they stop. I think one has to look at, let's say, a post-war is what you are looking at, essentially. A post-war leadership, which still feels, as you well pointed out, extremely beleaguered. I think any leadership in a transitional situation, still feeling beleaguered internally, because its actual controls are minimal, in one sense. Beleaguered externally would find it very difficult even to begin what we would call implementing desirable development goals. I don't know whether my colleague here, Yusuf Wanandi, would agree, but let me remind you that for numbers of years, Sukarno was regarded as an irrational leader. On the other hand, if one compares Indonesia today, one can say, with a number of other countries, the state is secure. Insofar as any state could be secure. The state was secure in this country. Nation and state were one until 1861. But anyhow, what I am saying is that confronted, one has to, at some extent, leadership has to perceive that I will say something more than the tensions, the incompatibility of trying to implement three different and sometimes internally inconsistent goals in terms of the available resources. We'll have to make four decisions, however unpleasant they may be, however irrational they may seem, may be the only available decisions in terms of what is the priority in a hierarchy of priorities. So, therefore, if maintenance of, let's put it this way, not only maintenance of the state, maintenance of internal security, absorption. At this point, one could say there is, as the state exists today, it requires absorption of elements that were hitherto at each other's throats in a variety of ways, not to mention internally in the South. It may very well be that the most rational pursuit at this point may involve all of these, from our perspective, irrational tendencies. I would argue that you may take issue with me. Perhaps I am saying something that should be said this afternoon. It is that in retrospect, all the economic irrationalities of Sukarno may or may not have been, one would have to ask what other paths could have been taken, may or may not have been a means in one way of maintaining the state which was beleaguered internally and in certain ways externally. It is only when certain things are secure that other things can be begun. And therefore, I think the problem is that you have what I would call an internalized sense very well of what is going on. But the... And I think we have all a great deal to gain from what you know and sense of what is going on. But the value-laden terms of your expressing them then, you know, causes some resistance to our recognizing and internalizing their utility.
Thank you, Anne. I think that's useful. Guy, first.
Thank you.
Yes, Peter.
I'm not going to make a speech, I'm going to attack a few people.
That's a good start.
I'll start with Ken Jobbitt. I find the initial point you made correct because it is tautological. You are saying that the Leninist state will not provide political rights to its citizens. Of course not. Once it provides political rights to its citizens, it's not a Leninist state. And therefore, we are really dealing with a question of semantics, not of analysis of political systems. The moment political rights will be granted, that state has transformed itself from a Leninist state into something else. So while I completely agree with your statement about the prospects for citizens' rights in a Leninist state, I think that conceptually, this is not the most felicitous way to put it. Bob, your paper, like all your papers, is so beautifully written that one is carried away with it, and the legere demand that you really speak on us appears only in the last few pages when you tell us, after we hold our breath, that you don't know how the succession problem is handled in communist states. And this is what I was hoping, because the rest, although it's always educative to read you, is the kind of stuff that others less industrious than you could also dig out. But I was hoping that you have philosopher's stone that would tell us how the succession problem really is handled in these systems. And I would like to make a suggestion, sticking my neck out. I think that we are looking in the wrong direction when we try to understand how these leadership changes occur from small group to another, Khrushchev to Brezhnev, Brezhnev to Andropov to Chernenko, etc. We try to understand that in the light of our experience with other political systems. I think that probably we could learn something if somebody would get together with the boys in the business schools who have some understanding of how people move up the ladder in the boards of the major corporations. How somebody who joins General Motors or IBM or so elbows his way up, passing dozens of other vice presidents, assuming that he had gotten to that point, which may be Central Committee equivalent, and finally ends up as a senior or executive vice president, and then gets the ultimate reward of being made the chief executive officer. I have a feeling, based on total ignorance, that inside that group, namely the management of a major corporate entity, something happens over a period of many years, and the infighting is fierce, as we all know, and somebody asserts himself as having the qualities that make the other members of the board feel that their interests will be better taken care of if that guy is put in charge than if somebody else is put in charge. But in the process, others, the competitors for the top position, lose out. This is of course true, but it must be that the majority of those who make the choices have reasons to believe that this guy is going to take care of their interests better than others. And we are looking in a completely wrong direction when we try to understand the system. Now, the issue of legitimacy, which has taken so much of our time, maybe he's preempting Don, but I'll give him credit. He came to me during coffee break or a juice break and asked whether I understand what on earth we are talking about. And I said that I don't either, because to me legitimacy means either, we agreed on this, it means one of Weber's three concepts. The king's in the pre-revolutionary Europe were legitimate because the people really believed that it was the will of God that Louis the something will be king of France. And they had thaumaturgic powers allegedly and all these things. They were legitimate because they had that particular quality. We consider legitimate that which is an expression of popular will. And even if Philippine elections were not pristine before 1972, every single president of the Philippines except Marcos was discharged after one term, right? And that made them legitimate. All of them were the process, the result of a process which, though imperfect, was an expression of popular will. And popular will in the Philippines may not have been 100% of the adult population, but popular will in the United States not that long ago was perhaps 4% of the total population, or in England before the Reform Act or so. So I really don't know what we talk about legitimacy. Does it mean that as long as you hold on to power by the use of force or police method or so, you are legitimate? In other words, are we saying that as long as you are there, you have the mandate of heaven and you are legitimate? Once you are kicked out or killed, you are no longer legitimate. I think that's not very useful. Now, I'd like to make a short point, take a dig at Doug Pike about his clandestinism business, on which he gives Ho Chi Minh as the outstanding example. The fact that Ho Chi Minh used 10 alliances or whatever before he surfaced as the leader of the Viet Minh seems to me irrelevant. Once he became the leader of the Democratic Republic of Vietnam, or whatever they called it in November 45, was it? At that point, he not only surfaced, but he was the least clandestine figure one could possibly imagine in Vietnam. And I doubt that there was a second, third, or fourth layer behind him telling Ho Chi Minh what to do. He was very much, at least a famous inter pares, but I think a little more than that, a leader. Now, about those 10 mysterious years, I know much less about Vietnam than Doc has forgotten. But could it be that because he worked for the Comintern for quite a long time, once he asserts himself as a nationalist communist leader and tries to convince us that he is the Thomas Jefferson or whatever of this country, and works with the OSS team, and so that Comintern background may be something that one doesn't want to put in the curriculum vitae when one applies for the new job. And finally, on Anne Wilner's point about maybe Sukarno's irrationality, economic irrationality, was a way to maintain a beleaguered state, if I heard you right. Or maintain his regime in a beleaguered state. Is that what you said?
What I am saying is that one cannot obtain all goals simultaneously.
Okay.
Then one, right, one has to make certain choices as to which has primacy.
What you are
saying. Right.
Because I think it's absolute nonsense to say that a society or a country or a government that is beleaguered by its own choice in part because of certain decisions it's made, and I have a lot of sympathy for the way Sukarno responded to the stupidity of the Dutch on holding on to Irian after 51 and therefore distorting the whole political life of the country for 10 years. But to say that in order to cope with those problems you put my late friend Mohamed Yamin in charge of economic development planning so that he will come out with an economic plan of which the major emphasis was that it would have 8 volumes, 17 chapters and 1945 articles, I think it's not.
But you're mistaking symbolism for actual intention. That was just a symbolic document.
But the plan,
nobody took
the
it
plan
I will let you stop this.
Was junk.
Yeah, okay.
Period.
I mean, okay, period. Okay. That's better. I think Professor Jovin would like to give your comment now and then end. And also,
so involved. Yes.
And don't cut me off just after I finish. Just to show how tough you are. I have finished.
I want to thank Professor Pauker for for defining our conversation in terms of attack, because this is the mode I'm most comfortable with. Let me speak to several of the things he said, including some of the things he addressed to Bob, which won't preclude Bob answering. Yes, it is a tautology to say that Leninism can't encompass democracy. I accept that and am aware of that. Tautologies are very useful. They're only useful, however, as preliminary statements. Now, what I would like to suggest is, in this tautology, that Leninism can encompass the existence of a political realm separate from that of the party, that it has multiple bases. The typical basis associated with this in the literature is that communists are omnivorous with respect to the demand for power. They want total power. I think that is true and completely superficial. Because what it doesn't explain is the motive force behind power. And there are alternative motive forces. One is people like power. I would suggest an alternative one, and that is the self-conception of what this party is about, what its goals in history are about, what the nature of membership is about. And in that sense, I think the notion of looking at a communist party not as simply an appropriation machine that tries to get goods for its members, not as simply a maintenance regime, but as a charismatic regime. And I mean by that very specific things. A membership that, even when it isn't able, is geared to the appropriateness of heroic action. It doesn't like routine action. Communists feel sullied by that. By dealing with extraordinary tasks, they're frustrated when they can't deal with that. And consequently, they will resist democracy not simply because democracy threatens their power, but because it reduces their status to that of common citizenship. And I think they will fight that on the basis of ideal interests, not simply material interests. So I hope that's a specification of the point that I was making, and I do really thank Professor Pop for raising that question. About the appropriateness of business, I think that's incorrect. But I think the idea behind it is correct. What we want to look at is not business schools, but the Vatican. The Vatican. Yes, and the problem with the Vatican is there's even less information about businesses.
But that's why I sent you to the beginning.
I know, but you know, that's the problem with behavioral science. You study what you can measure, except what you can measure is never the most important thing. The point is that it's in the Vatican and in the Curia that you will find a charismatic power organization that has to select. How did they choose Wojtyla as opposed to somebody else? Let me expand on it just briefly, because it's a fascinating question, and I'm in complete sympathy with your being intrigued. How do certain people become leaders? I think there is a genetic base, not in the physical sense, but in the organizational sense, and a developmental base. I would guess that one of the ways in which political leaders assert themselves is by demonstrating physical courage to their colleagues. I would bet any amount of money that one of the reasons Khrushchev beat Malenkov has nothing to do with he was for the party and Malenkov was for the government. Malenkov ran as many parts of the party as Khrushchev ever got near. He had as many people in the military, the secret police, as Khrushchev ever had. He had as wide a range of experience, and from everything we know, was every bit as bright and progressive when he first took over, and he lost. And I would suggest that in a setting of intense political conflict, a very basic, God forbid, primordial element might simply be not only physical stamina, which I think really is a very self-selecting device within politicians, but also physical courage is not to be ignored. It impresses people, because most of us aren't courageous physically. There's a second thing, and that is, along with physical courage, different leaders have to have different virtues at different developmental stages in the history of their organization. Andropov succeeded for lots of reasons, which I'd be happy to go through, but one reason is because everyone trusted him not to kill the others. That is to say, one of the major features of any communist succeeding now in a post-class struggle setting is that they accept the notion that, formulated by Lenin, quoted by every Soviet now that tries to run for office, is that we have to treat our comrades not in a rude fashion, like Stalin did. So I would suggest there are both genetic and developmental facets about what it is that specifies certain people as not naturals, but likely to become leaders. Finally, about your suggestion, Ho Chi Minh, I love it.
that he wanted to hide from his Comintern experience. Do you know that if one looks at the biographies of Tito, one finds the most public display of all his virtues except from 1936 to 1939, when he was working for the Comintern, when his name was Walter, and when he was despicable.
Well, I
just offer it as a second guess to reinforce your first. Thank you.
I'm becoming moderately aroused. Let me say this, that while I accept the theoretical framework of charisma versus,
what I do see,
as it were, institutionalization,
what I think is very important,
I don't think there's an ounce of charisma in Chernenko. I don't think there's any charisma today in the CPSU. I don't think that there is any element of charisma driving the so-called Marxist-Leninist state in the Soviet Union. What I do see, and what I think is very important, is an increasing reliance upon certain mechanisms, if you will, of decision making, upon certain rules of power holding and maintenance that are not exclusively Leninist at all, that fit into a whole range of societies. For example, Gies, and I think legitimately, the question of how leadership is chosen in a society like this. I'm a great multi-cause boy myself. I don't think there's a single base upon which such leadership is chosen, but I would advance three or four bases. I think there is a balance of interests. Now, I'm very deeply involved in the selection of top leadership in the Soviet Union. I think there's also a threat avoidance element, which is the flip side. That is, you want to choose people who do not threaten you as you perceive it. You may be wrong, but as you perceive it. And I think there's also a very strong patron-client factor involved. Now, all of these things, interest balancing, threat avoidance, patron-client factors, are involved in the current decision-making process. I think there may have been a time when some of these elements could not be played out because of the overweening influence of coercion within the system at the top. I think it was very, very difficult in the immediate post-Lenin period to have a rational expression on a collegial basis, oligarchic basis, of these factors because of the overwhelming influence of coercion within the system. That is to say, some people were simply knocked down. And Stalin's use of terrorism, and particularly his use of killing his opponents, in a certain sense, obviated politics. I mean, you can't have politics when you kill everybody. And I think that the evolution of this system, one might say the institutionalization of the system, is when you move from that particular stage to a stage where there is an interaction of an oligarchy. And you have certain what I might call natural or elemental elements taking place in decision making. Now, I would argue that while charisma is playing a very, very small role in the Soviet Union today, it is playing a very large role in North Korea. And that is reflective of different stages to some degree, but let me make it clear that I think you could go back to charisma. That is, I think Weber was wrong in assuming some kind of unilineal trend from charisma to bureaucratization. No, they are coexisting.
Weber didn't.
Well, Weber's disciples did this. And I think you can, any society in crisis may revert to certain elemental principles.
And
so I'm not predicting for all time what the USSR will be. But I think that there is this distinction. Now, the question of legitimacy, you know, to me,
but it seems to
I have a very simple definition of legitimacy, but I think it's a necessary one. The voluntary acceptance of the right of a given government to rule or of a given political system to prevail. Voluntary is important because, of course, you can have a coercive system that doesn't permit any test of legitimacy or in degree does not. But it seems to me that no matter what the culture, no matter what the way in which to determine this, every society, you have to have a concept of legitimacy. It's elemental and essential in the concept of governance. Now, I mean, at the height of the ultranationalist movement in pre-war Japan, you might say that legitimacy based upon a set of myths, the sufficient number of people believed about the emperor and the emperor's system. It had nothing to do with elections or choice or anything of that sort. I don't see any connection between this and democracy or even free choice. But every society has some concepts that go with the continuum between legitimacy and alienation. And without that, we can't talk about politics. You can't talk about politics without some such concepts. Let me just conclude by saying that I think the fundamental difference between Ken and myself, and I'm not sure how deeply it goes, because sometimes expressions obscure compatibilities or difference, but the difference that I have sensed is that Ken has a penchant for dealing with pureness, and I have a penchant for dealing with corruption. I have a penchant for dealing with human systems that are actually operative, not ideals, not models in this sense. Now, let me just conclude by saying that as I look at the Chinese system today, down at the grassroots, and indeed at the Chinese system even at earlier periods, what I see is a system, incidentally, where middle-level cadres or local cadres who were party people, part of the lower elite, were caught in an enormous set of pressures. There was such a thing as public pressure, and is public pressure operative upon these elites to try to get their interests represented, and in many cases successfully or quasi-successfully, and upper elites trying to define the broad principles and programs and get these executed. And these middle and lower elites faced an enormous problem in coming to grips, on the one hand, with the citizenry, and on the other hand, with the pressures of the system. And many of them resigned or committed suicide, even in the more extreme cases, because they couldn't cope with those pressures. Now, this does not suggest, incidentally, some kind of compartmentalization between party monolithism and citizenry at large. Much more porous, much more flexible, much more human. And we've got to find ways to measure the kinds of pressures that are operative in a system of growing pluralism under developmental conditions that erodes ideology and wears down goals. Not irreversible, I insist. It's not a movement that is unilineal, but one that is going to be recurrent to the nature of these systems, just as I think in liberal societies you are going to face some of the same issues. I don't see these as totally compartmentalized. That, to me, is the difference between us.
If one looks at charisma.
Well, first, if we could deal with what I think is a bit of a straw man, that is Scalapino as Sancho Panza and Jowett as Don Quixote, with Bob looking at the real world and Jowett's Catholic past imposing Platonic forms on him. If one looks at charisma, I think what one has to distinguish is personalized charisma and what Weber called routinized charisma. I really don't think I would be caught saying Chernenko is charisma. I'm not even sure he's alive. The point simply is that the party, the Communist Party of the Soviet Union, just like the Marine Corps, just like the Catholic Church, has a self-conception of itself which is not legal rational, which is not democratic. It expresses it. It worries when it does not have available to it styles of action that are heroic. It is more comfortable in certain milieus and not in others. And I would predict and bet, without ever having visited China, that there are lots of cadres in China today who are very, very upset over what accountants and agronomists would never be upset about, and that is a procedural, legal, rational way of dealing with economic development. It's going to be a persistent problem. It is in the Soviet Union and everywhere else. That does not mean they will necessarily lose it, that they are not leftists. It just means they weigh their legal, rational components and their charismatic ones differently than the people that they oppose. Furthermore, you can have organizations that maintain this charismatic notion, that is the notion of political exclusivity and this desire, this continual penchant for extraordinary types of action, while not being able to act on it. And this can lead to their demise. I have no doubt about that, but I equally have no doubt about their nature. Next to last, the point about, at the local levels, people demanding the right to articulate. I haven't the slightest doubt that that exists in every country, particularly at certain levels of socio-cultural, not necessarily economic development. Economic development is not necessarily associated with the articulation by society for political rights. It happened in the 17th century in western Pennsylvania, and the economic conditions were absolutely absent. It's just there were some Puritans around, they wanted to talk. So you don't need necessarily economic conditions in order to do it. The point is that these movements are high-risk movements, ad hoc movements, not legitimated by the government. And that's why democracy walls really are made of plywood, not of oak. They're easily taken down. Finally, the point about legitimacy. I could not agree more with Bob about the absolute necessity of having such a concept available. And without going into Weber, whom I am both interested in and I think qualified to talk about, let me just mention four possibilities. You can have a stance towards government that's based on resistance. There we don't talk about legitimacy. You can have a much more regular stance of avoidance. For example, if you go to Czechoslovakia today, you find almost 20 million people engaged in the most adept avoidance of anything political because they despise it. They don't resist it because they'll be hurt. But avoidance is a very real political stance, and it signifies lack of legitimacy. Third, you can find support. Now, support is getting close to legitimacy. I don't think it's quite the same thing. I think it has to do with an instrumental consideration of what it is that will benefit you and what it is that will hurt you. And finally, there's identification. And identification is what we mean by legitimacy. Identification refers to associating the regime or polity that you live in as something that you value as part of your own identity. Now, as far as I can see, in the Leninist world, maybe Yugoslavia to some extent, maybe Hungary to some extent, has achieved legitimacy. Not an absolute legitimacy, but then that hasn't been achieved in the United States either. But nevertheless, I think a credible amount of legitimate support exists in these two. In most North Korea, I can't say because I just don't know. I doubt it, actually. And I doubt it for reasons you mentioned in your paper. When you point out, this is to show you I read it, when you point out three features of North Korea, which I think are extremely important, A, the sense of pressure in the population, B, the level of corruption that exists, and also just the amount of repression. I find it very difficult in the presence of a fairly long period of industrialization among significant parts of the population, education and urbanization, that there aren't people there who at best are supporting it, that don't find it very legitimate at all. Well, again, Vietnam and China, you're asking me to give conclusions that you need, in this instance, really some data to talk about. I would suggest that there are large numbers of Chinese who find the current regime legitimate. That is to say, they identify with it. People, particularly some people, I wouldn't even venture to say how many, some people in the party, but that a very broad stratum of people in China support it. And that's what we're looking for. You see, I'm suggesting that we can take the notion of legitimacy and do something differentiated with it. We can ask which segments of the population would like to resist or are trying, or in Vietnam, which are avoiding the regime. That is to say, they just want to live their lives and get this regime out of their face. They don't want to even look at it. Third is support it, and support it for career reasons, for familial reasons, or for nationalistic reasons separate from Leninism. And finally, those who identify with it. I think that gives us a very nice way to initially break down something that otherwise we're presented with this either-or. Is it legitimate or isn't it legitimate? There's no such thing as is it legitimate or isn't it.
Thank you.
I am pleased to feel, I'm very reassured at the moment, having spent many too many years working out the notions of legitimacy, authority, and so forth in Weber in relation to charisma, I feel that there is going to be quite an audience for a recently published book. I will not recapitulate my first chapter and my appendix. I'm trying to clarify some confusions. But let me say here that I think one of our problems is that, first of all, legitimacy is, as Ken says, it's not an all or none phenomenon. One of the problems in those of us who have followed Weber and his categories is Weber never clearly made the distinction between authority and leadership, meaning the legitimacy of a system as distinct from the legitimacy of leadership, and particularly in the case of the category of charisma. It has been confused because charisma can both be leadership, charismatic leadership, and it can be the basis of authority in a system. That is how it's distinguished from the other two categories of authority. But what I mean by that is that the legitimacy of the institution of the presidency was not really undermined by the perceptions of the illegitimacy of Mr. Nixon. And I think it's very important that one distinguishes legitimacy of what is being looked at. It is important whether the legitimacy of the incumbent, even if the incumbent may have come in by legitimate modes in the rational legal sense, can be perceived as illegitimate by virtue of the exercise of that role. Legitimacy essentially, and I will not elaborate, but I agree in that sense with Ken's definition. First of all, legitimacy is in the eyes of the people. And they can be very divided. We can have transitional situations, and I'd like to suggest that at one period in what was Cambodia, we have an example of a very mixed system, as Weber himself was clear to indicate. There are such things as mixed systems. So that the leadership... at one time of a gentleman who, well, I don't even know where he is, some of you can tell me, Nuruddin Sihanouk, was in the eyes of some people, he was legitimate because he came from a royal family. In the eyes of another segment, he was legitimate because he held a post that was achieved under legal, rational modes of selection. In the eyes of another group of people, he was legitimated because he was a charismatic, because of their reaction to him in charismatically oriented terms. If one asks what was the dominant system of authority, one would have to do, in effect, a survey of how many people perceived him in one set of terms and how many people perceived him in another set of terms. Now, I think it's when we talk of charisma, there a distinction certainly must be made between the charisma of an individual and what is similar to that attached to or to some extent designated by the original achiever of charisma to an organization. Very attenuated charisma. And perhaps that is what is happening today, is that it's gotten very weak, and that says Bob may be right.
In an up-down framework. Let me suggest
also, and I don't want to elaborate here what I was trying to do on the board yesterday, which was I think to avoid the kinds of semantic arguments, we have to disaggregate because we are looking at legitimacy in, how would I put it, in an up and down framework from the state, the system, and each of these can be changed by virtue of what goes on in another segment depending on people's perception. All kinds of legitimacy really are in the eyes of the people, and we can't make make guesses when we cannot find out how people are perceiving which units, whether a system, its leadership, modes of exercising authority and or leadership at any given time. So not only is legitimacy rarely at any one time an all or none phenomenon, its types at any one time can be in a mix, and it can be any one type can be larger or smaller. And I do agree with Kevin, I do agree with Bob, but there, you know, this in itself, it is important, but it is a not easily known phenomenon where we cannot measure it.
Thank you, Anne.
In reality.
I think there is a thing clear now, by now, on legitimacy. Let's move now, because otherwise we don't have time. I have only 15 minutes left, and I have Don, Anne, Hadi, Say, and Carl. So you can imagine everybody of each of you 2 minutes. Don?
I think one could say that parties in communist countries must change quite broad and at least not hinder economic development, at least not be an obstacle to economic development, in order for it to gain a greater degree of power. Except the other hand, that's the party that's both countries would accept that there is more. To the extent that the party remains an expressive, widely regarded as something that is not useful, maybe even hinder our development. That's actually the other thing, like creating the prospect of delegitimization of the party. On the other hand, if you have a party as in Hungary, right, the party is now in China beginning to try to move towards enhancing economic development in modern day, and I think that you will have a kind of re-legitimization of a modern party. I think that's what Qatar successfully did in Hungary by freeing the peasant and deprivatizing to some extent and increasing economic development because of the Chinese currency. That's how I would look at the discussion. The second point I want to make is on the this question of the relationship between legitimacy and democracy. It's all very well to tell our friends there's no necessary relationship between legitimacy and democracy. And of course, that's true. I think Kent's four categories and Anne's categories yesterday are very helpful. There are degrees of legitimacy. And you don't have to have a Westminster type system or an election to have a more legitimate authority. On the other hand, there's a very useful way to test whether a system, a political system, is legitimate or not. And a free election is one very useful way to test it. And it's not an accident that free elections have arisen with civil liberties.